Hi, this is Jack Shalom. Less than 10 years ago, former NSA employee Edward Snowden blew the whistle on the U.S. government's illegal, unconstitutional, worldwide warrantless surveillance plan. Throughout history, brave whistleblowers have risked their lives and livelihoods for what they considered the greater good. But what is the cost these whistleblowers pay? And more importantly, how do the successful whistleblowers succeed? Our guest today has written a how-to guide for would-be whistleblowers, uncovering many of the traps and missteps one can fall into. I'm happy to be talking with the author of the book, A Public Service: Whistleblowing, Disclosure, and Anonymity, author Tim Schwartz. Tim, what prompted you to write the book?
I'm an artist as well as an author and an activist. And when Trump was elected and I kind of saw how he was treating some people that were standing up to power, I got frustrated. And I started working on a small guide for federal employees to blow the whistle, how they could release information. And as I started doing it and researching, I realized that just giving someone a simple guide for how to do it would actually probably be a detriment to them. You know, if you really just simply took information from your workplace and handed it to the press without any thought to your livelihood, how to do it, you'd probably end up in jail or, you know, losing a job or something like that. So I backed up. I did a lot of research. I did a lot of interviews. And I tried to construct a book and a way to think about this that could prepare people to blow the whistle in any context, really.
Well, if we review the way that most whistleblowers are treated, would you say it's true that no good deed goes unpunished?
I wouldn't say that exactly. I would say that there are a lot of hurdles to changing a system for good. And I think there's a lot of people that will try to take you out, try to ruin your life. But many people now are doing it and doing it right and building their own careers and livelihoods out of it and changing systems as they do it. So I'm glad. I think we're in, maybe not the heyday, but we're in a good place where there's a lot of organizations out there to support whistleblowers. And there's a lot of information about how to do it in the most responsible and protective way for yourself.
A whistleblower hopes there's some kind of responsive system or process to deal with abuses of power. Is that realistic?
Let me put it this way. I think it's very difficult for a system internally to change itself. Oversight, I think, needs to come from the outside and regulation. And to change a system, I think it's much easier or maybe more productive to go to the outside.
I was sort of astounded that sometimes the retaliation against a whistleblower has nothing to do with the whistleblower hurting the company in any way, but is a matter of control. You talk about one instance about Elon Musk retaliating against a leaker who was seeking to save the company $150 million. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. So at the Giga plant in Nevada that produces batteries for Tesla, Martin Tripp, who was working there shortly after it opened, and this is a huge, huge plant, realized that it just wasn't set up effectively. It was too new. People didn't know what was going on. And there was a lot of kind of wrongs going on in the plant. But one in particular he saw was a huge waste of materials. Upwards of 40% of the materials in there were being wasted. And so Martin Tripp took this information to the press. It went out, and very quickly, Elon Musk, you know, rallied private investigators, rallied his internal team, and they went after Martin Tripp with a vengeance. So much so that they put in a fake gun threat that supposedly came from Tripp. They sent the sheriff after him, and this guy's livelihood was ruined really quickly. And in fact, I think he ended up moving to Hungary to kind of get away because his whole life had been turned upside down in this one instance of releasing information that should have saved the company millions and millions of dollars.
It's remarkable. What has Obama and Trump's respective records been on responding to whistleblowers?
I really thought when I started writing this book that from all of the rhetoric and speeches I had heard from Obama, that he was really protective and supportive of those that speak out. And he was, you know, for a very transparent government. But what it turns out to be is Obama, probably more than anybody else before him, any of his predecessors, went after those that leak information and whistleblower information from the government with a vengeance. There's the Espionage Act from 1917. And before Obama, only one person had been fully charged with the Espionage Act. During Obama's administration, eight others were charged and put in jail for releasing information under the Espionage Act. And it's basically been changed into an act that any information released can be seen as an act of treason. And there's basically no way for the person that releases that information to have a valid argument in court because the government has deemed that treason. It's pretty ridiculous.
And that's being used against Julian Assange right now.
And Snowden.
And Snowden. Well, what do you say to critics of people like Ed Snowden or Chelsea Manning when they say, well, they should have followed the protocols and gone through the proper channels? I mean, should you go through the proper channels first to forestall criticism, or is that giving up your anonymity an element of surprise?
We can talk about anonymity in a second, but the right channels, I think, really depend on the circumstances. And I personally recommend anybody that comes and talks to me to likely talk to a lawyer first or a specific whistleblower organization that will know the different avenues and paths to approach this. I'm not saying that going internally to the inspector general won't work, but you know, it really depends on the circumstances. Certainly Edward Snowden, and if he had gone internally, nothing would have happened. Thomas Drake is another example who had seen, you know, others internally at the NSA try to go and have the IG make changes. And it was only by going externally to the press that really the public was informed and pressure could be put on the NSA or other government agencies to change.
Well, okay, let's talk about that then. What's the first step to take when you feel like you may need to whistleblow?
So in my book, I really argue for starting from a point of anonymity and doing anonymous research. Anonymous research could mean going to a library and searching on a web browser there that's disconnected from your identity. Could mean going and buying a different cell phone or tablet to do research that way. But the point is to start from a position of having a different identity, one that isn't connected to yourself, to start gathering information. And why this is important, just in general, is I'm sure many of you are aware that most everything is tracked now. So if you type into something to Google, it's tracked. If you start searching for things, there could be a way for someone else to infer who you are and what you are looking at. A simple example would be, say, a mother in an abusive relationship that wants to find a way out of that. Mm-hmm. If she on her phone started searching for support organizations, her partner could find that and cause more abuse. So by doing it in a secure and anonymous way, there's a possibility to gain information without revealing yourself. From there, just looking up lawyers and particularly whistleblower organization, support organizations that could support you and getting in contact with them. There's a tendency we've seen recently for people to go directly to the press immediately. And I think I'm a big fan of the press. I think it is an amazing way to shine the light on abuses of power. But, you know, first and foremost, the press's priority is the public and informing the public, not necessarily the whistleblower. So I think it's a dance and figuring out who's going to be the best partner to share that information.
Well, what are some of the pitfalls in trying to stay anonymous?
I think, first of all, is just using your cell phone. Everything is so wrapped up in your cell phone and this device you carry around all the time, whether it's your location that's being tracked, who your contacts are, what information you've sent and logged, that it's really, if you are trying to make an anonymous profile or do anything anonymously or privately on your phone, it's probably going to get messed up. So that's why I think just, you know, walking to Best Buy and buying a $50 cell phone in cash and taking it to Starbucks and using their Wi-Fi to then do research, you could potentially set up a new email account and email a contact, whether it's at the press or a lawyer, to set up a meeting. You've really separated yourself from your data. And I think that's probably the most important mindset that people need to start to adhere to. And the other starting point that isn't exactly anonymous, but that many people forget about is within your organization, making sure the information that you think is correct is correct, whether it's slowly talking to others, your colleagues, and trying to understand if they have the same perspective you do. And that way you can also build support for later on when you do reveal information that you have other people to back you up.
In your book, you talk about ways that your anonymity could be broken, and it's kind of mind-boggling. You recommend that people use Tor or one of these anonymous kinds of computer browsers, but you also say that even those are not foolproof because there's so many ways that you can be traced back.
Yeah, I do recommend Tor. Tor stands for the Onion Routing. It is a piece of software that's a browser like Chrome, but it routes its information through multiple computers around the world, and basically no one can know who you are as long as you're just looking at information. Of course, once you log into something like Facebook, they know who you are.
You know, if you're the only person in a company that has access to a particular document, well, then no matter what computer you use, you're vulnerable. In the old detective stories, we had senders of anonymous letters unmasked by analyzing the typewriter print. You know, like the loop of the E was always clogged with ink, or there was a stutter in the space key. So evidently, each typewriter had a unique set of quirks that could be discovered on inspection. And what about modern day printers?
So before I get to modern day printers, I'll just talk about this concept of uniqueness, which is a little different than anonymity, because that's exactly what you're talking about. Reality Winner is a great example where they had access to the documents on the government computer. And when they looked back, the researchers and analysts, they saw that only six people had access to that document. So really quickly, you know, the pool of suspects became six. And the point there is you can have anonymity software, you can have things that protect your identity, but if you are doing it in a unique way that makes you the kind of red flag or the red dot, then using all the software in the world doesn't protect you. Coming back to printers, it is astounding to know that there's something called micro dots that come out of all laser printers. And they basically, they're very, very pale yellow dots that can only be seen with a magnifying glass. They come out of every page of a laser printer, and they identify the time, the network ID, you know, the user, basically everything about that piece of paper that's coming out. And so if you print off something at work and send it to a reporter, and that reporter doesn't know about how to sanitize those documents well, and they publish it online, the investigators could really quickly look at that PDF and identify what printer printed it.
Wow. And the documents themselves have information embedded in them, don't they?
Yeah. So I have a chapter that's just documentation gathering, sanitization, and storage.
Once you're connected to the internet, I mean, if you're connected to Wi-Fi, can you be tracked?
Sure. But that's why I recommend, for example, using a VPN. If you've got an anonymous device, using it at a hotspot or a Starbucks that isn't your typical Wi-Fi, and then using an anonymous email account, like if you've got Proton Mail is a great example of an encrypted email service from Switzerland that people could create a free account on that is totally deassociated from their own identity and use that for passing information back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Even if we're very sophisticated, it may be that the journalists we try and get in touch with or the lawyers that we try and get in touch with are not as sophisticated. How should lawyers and journalists be approached?
One of the reasons I focus on anonymous research is that you can research anonymously who might be a good partner. You know, if you are blowing the whistle on agriculture issues, reading newspaper articles and looking at who's already covering the topic and seeing if they give signs that they are up on this technology. So they've got a tips page, or they're listing a Proton Mail account, or some way to contact them that is safe. You know, a Signal Messenger is an encrypted instant messenger on phones. And if a journalist is listing that, we think, okay, they know what they're doing. They're in this sphere of the place I'm interested in whistleblowing on, and they're up to speed on technology. So I'm going to reach out and contact them.
I just want to get back to one thing about being anonymous and protecting your information. What's the most important thing to know about creating a password?
This is one of my favorites. So creating a password, let's just be clear, Jack. Probably everybody's passwords are horrible, or 95% of people's passwords are horrible. The most important thing when it comes to a password is the length. Every character or digit you add to a password makes it, you know, that much harder to break. An easy way to do this is to flip open a book. I find I've trained my parents to do this. Take a random book, flip it open, put your finger on a word, do that four times, create a sentence out of those four words, and that's a new, very random password that is easily memorizable.
That seems to be the downfall for a lot of people, including myself. It's easy enough to create a random password, but how to remember and recall it? Sure, maybe I can remember and recall one, but you know, I've got 50 of them. What am I going to do?
Yeah, that's why I recommend password managers. They're a program that runs on your computer that's encrypted. I say people need to remember three passwords, one to get into your computer, one to get into your password manager. And then I always recommend people memorize the password to their email. So if they lose everything and they need to get back in. And if you can remember the password to your password manager, then you can get into all your passwords.
How do you think the prosecution of Julian Assange is affecting the landscape?
That is a really tough, hard case. And I feel so bad for how he's been treated over the years. It's a shame. I think at this point, they're out to get Assange for whatever they can. And I hope he makes it out of this okay.
Yeah. I can't imagine. They really want to make an example of him.
Yeah.
Well, Tim Schwartz, what's the most important thing that you know about whistleblowing?
I know that whistleblowing can be such a great change for good and can really help organizations, systems, systemic issues be changed, abuses of power, even standing up to harassers and sexual harassment. Those are all people that are whistleblowing. And I think the more people trust that they can find a safe pathway to release this information and make a change in the world, the more people will continue to do this. And I'm so thankful that there are many organizations out there, and they're growing and growing by the day, you know, whether it's the Government Accountability Project or the Signals Network, that do real support for whistleblowers. I'm just thankful for the whistleblowers out there that have decided to stand up. And I'm thankful that there are organizations out there and that the press continues to inform the public and support those sources that come through.
Tim, as we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add?
I would encourage anybody out there to look up some of these privacy software out there, you know, whether it's Signal or Wire for instant messaging, or download Tor and try it out, just to get a little bit familiar with these tools so that if something does happen in the future, you know, a great example is you can easily see in the future with insurance companies that potentially, they're going to be mining our data, seeing what diseases we could potentially have in the future, and changing our rates based on that. So if you have maybe a health issue or a potential health issue or even a mental health issue, doing that research anonymously makes it less likely that someone could change your insurance premiums, could prejudge you, could potentially not give you a job because there's information out there online about who you are, what issues you might have. So just using Tor generally or going to a library to do research online, I think is an important thing to think about.
That's great advice. Thanks so much. I've been speaking with Tim Schwartz, author of A Public Service, published by OR Books. This is Jack Shalom for Arts Express with host Prairie Miller. Secret Haven!